I'm Tracy Sable. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, airstrikes across Lebanon. More than a dozen people are dead after the latest offensive from Israel. We have analysis of the worsening conditions from Aaron David Miller. Polls and percentages. With the election drawing closer, we go inside the numbers in the tight race between Vice President Harris and former President Trump. Real dedication. New developments in the former megachurch in California, now part of the Diocese of Orange. Plus, walking with our Lord. We take you to downtown Manhattan and a unique event focused on the Eucharist. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, the war in the Middle East. Israeli airstrikes pummeled southern Lebanon today, including Beirut suburbs, despite U.S. objections over the scope of the bombing campaign. Since Israel escalated the war against Hezbollah, the Lebanese government estimates more than 1,500 people have died and more than 1 million have been displaced. The acting leader of Hezbollah states the Lebanese militant group will ramp up attacks on Israel following an airstrike on an apartment in Lebanon earlier this week. This comes as the Biden administration warns Israel to increase humanitarian aid in Gaza or risk losing access to American weapons funding. And for more on the situation, let's bring in Aaron David Miller, who is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is a Middle East expert, author, and former negotiator. Aaron, thank you so much for your time today. We always appreciate it. A number of media outlets are reporting that Israel will carry out its retaliatory attack on Iran before the U.S. election. What do you think will happen? And if so, what type of impact would that have on the race?
I mean, I think that's right. I think the Israelis, again, they're responding to the October 1st strike of 180-plus ballistic missiles of at least 50 of them actually got through and impacted. Fortunately, there were only two Israelis were lightly wounded, and a Palestinian man in Jericho was killed by interceptor or missile debris. I think the Israelis will respond. I think it'll be in October. It'll be before the election. I think their target set right now, again, according to reporting out of Washington and Israel, the Israelis will confine themselves to military targets, ballistic missile launchers, production facilities, maybe Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, command and control facilities. But the Israeli Minister of Defense is arguing that, or saying that, that the attack will be deadly, precise, and surprising, which makes you wonder what other targets they have in mind. Then the question is, how will the Iranians respond? If they respond the way they did on October 1st or in a heavier way, I think we're then on the cusp of an escalatory cycle that could literally create a multi-front war with very unpredictable and dangerous consequences, including U.S. involvement.
Yeah, I also want to turn now and talk about Gaza. The Israeli Defense Forces say 50 trucks carrying humanitarian aid entered into Gaza today. It's in response to a letter from the U.S. threatening to cut off military supplies if they didn't comply. The Israeli Defense Minister said that his country will not impose a, quote, starvation plan in Gaza. I want to get your thoughts on that.
You know, I don't think let me begin this way. The Americans sent a similar letter in April. And I would note this letter was not signed by the president or the vice president. It was a letter from Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense to Minister of Strategic Affairs and the Israeli Minister of Defense. I don't think it was intended as a threat. I've heard the word ultimatum released. I don't think that's where we're going with this. In April, the letter, a similar letter, ended up actually producing a pretty positive Israeli reaction, but it was a one-off. And I think what the administration is looking for is a sustained Israeli commitment.
Yeah. One more thing to touch on here. Today, Israel struck near Beirut. This again after the U.S. said that it opposed the bombardment. Do U.S. warnings, do you think, carry any weight at this point?
I mean, they do. Will they outweigh strategic Israeli calculations when it comes to specific strikes? They could. They could create some restraint. But by and large, I think This Israeli government understands that the Biden administration is really boxed in. We're weeks away from one of the most consequential elections in modern American history, and I don't think the Biden administration wants a major fight, let alone be put in the position where it's somehow forced to restrict or condition assistance to Israel. Once the election is determined, is run, however, depending on who wins, the administration may be more inclined during a lame duck period to perhaps present a tougher approach.
Aaron David Miller, always appreciate your time and your insights. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the latest string of flare-ups between North and South Korea is raising concern among U.S. officials. This comes as North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un accuses its rival South Korea of flying drones over the capital to drop anti-North propaganda leaflets. The North described it as a provocation that could lead to armed conflict and even war, sending more troops to the border. According to the Korean Central News Agency, this has also prompted a surge of new enlistments, reportedly eager to participate in a holy war to defend against perceived threats. All right, now to the campaign trail here in the United States. With less than 3 weeks until Election Day, in vitro fertilization is once again making headlines. Today, both candidates discussing IVF, which the Catholic Church says is, quote, unequivocally judged to be immoral and is a terrible offense against human life. White House correspondent, that is, Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, good evening to you. Former President Donald Trump appeared on Fox News for an all-female audience town hall. IVF came up, and Vice President Kamala Harris quickly blasted what Donald Trump said.
Former President Donald Trump called himself the father of IVF at a Fox News town hall, adding Republicans really are the party for IVF. Trump earlier this year released a video explaining his position on in vitro fertilization, a common but expensive fertility treatment, which the Catholic Church states is morally wrong because it destroys embryos.
We want to make it easier for mothers and families to have babies, not harder. That includes supporting the availability of fertility treatments like IVF.
Before boarding a flight in Detroit, headed for a campaign visit to Pennsylvania, Vice President Kamala Harris responds to Trump's father of IVF comment.
Well, about last night. Donald Trump, I found it to be quite bizarre, actually, called himself the father of IVF.
And Harris said what Trump should take responsibility for is that
Couples who are praying and hoping and working toward growing a family have been so disappointed and harmed by the fact that IVF treatments have now been put at risk.
The founder of the Faith and Freedom Coalition defends Trump and blasts Harris.
I know that he's pro-life personally. I know that he is the most pro-life president in American history. And behind door number two is Kamala Harris running on the most radical and extreme pro-abortion agenda of any candidate in history.
Meanwhile, with November 5th moving in fast, another national poll, this one from Marquette University Law School in Milwaukee, asking likely voters who their choice is for president. It reveals Harris stands at 48% and Trump at 47%.
Also in that Marquette poll, 4% of respondents said they'd vote for another candidate. Wisconsin, of course, is one of several critical states, both Trump and Harris, each trying to win at the White House. Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, thank you, Owen. And for more on the polling numbers, we turn now to Andrew Walworth, host of the Real Clear Politics radio show on Sirius XM. Andrew, always good to be with you. We just heard from Owen mentioning a poll from Marquette Law School that has Vice President Harris up by a slim margin. Just one point. I know you discussed in a recent podcast whether Democrats are panicking, basing the question on recent media reports. Talk to us more about that and what you are seeing from current polling. How tight is this race?
Well, it's a very tight race, and you can look at these numbers, and if you want to see good numbers for Harris, you look at those national numbers where she is up, and in our average, she's up about 1.7% in the popular vote overall. But that's not the way elections work. We all know that. It comes down to the Electoral College, and in the Electoral College, especially if you look at the battleground states, the seven states that are going to make make up the decision this time around. Trump is up 0.7% in that average. So it's a very tight race. It could go either way. Are the Democrats panicking? That might be too strong a term, Tracy, but they certainly seem worried. And you hear reports out of the campaign that you hear when there's a lot of strife inside a campaign and there's sort of finger pointing going on. So, yeah, I think the Democrats are, like I say, panicking may be too strong, but I think they're worried when they look at these numbers.
Yeah, I want to talk about early voting now, already underway in a handful of swing states, including in Virginia and Michigan. What are we seeing so far, and how do the numbers that we have so far, how do they compare to 2020 as far as the turnout?
Well, the turnout is up in early voting. I was in Savannah, Georgia, yesterday when they started early voting. Down there, they've had 400,000 people, roughly, vote on the first day. That's about twice what they had, it's more than twice what they had last time around. Probably another 200,000 or so voted today. So the numbers I'm seeing, that could be as much as 10% of the electorate is out and voted on the first 2 days. It's an incredible number. We are seeing a lot of early voting. Virginia, which you mentioned, the numbers there look pretty good for the Republicans because the Republicans didn't do so well on early voting last time around. But it's too soon to tell. But certainly both campaigns knew that early voting and absentee voting was going to be important this time around. Both campaigns have really doubled down on it. Democrats have a traditional or conventional advantage in early voting. They certainly showed last time around. We'll see if the Republicans were able to catch up.
Yeah. And both candidates, as we know, have been really stumping hard in battleground states recently, right, in particular Georgia and also Pennsylvania. Any indication who has the upper hand right now, Andrew, in these pivotal states? And which state is really the must win? What do you think?
Well, all eyes are in Pennsylvania. That's the most electoral votes of any of the swing states. So that's where people are focused. It's also among the tightest. I've never seen anything like this where we had a whole string of polls that were tied. That rarely happens. So Pennsylvania is where people will be watching. But there are seven swing states: Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia. Right now, Trump is leading in six of those. Harris is leading only in Wisconsin, and there she has only a 0.3% lead right now. So, it could be what they call a narrow sweep. It could be that Trump wins. If he wins all these swing states, and he only has to win them by a couple votes, right? It could look like in the Electoral College, like a blowout, and it could be very tight, or he could lose in the general election, which sometimes happens.
Yeah, and it remains to be seen. It is going to be interesting for sure. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Tracy.
All right, from abortion to immigration to the U.S. economy, incumbent Republican Senator Ted Cruz and Democratic challenger Congressman Colin Allred squared off in a fast and fiery debate. The winner of their race will be the next U.S. senator for the state of Texas. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales reviews some of the highlights and what's at stake. Eric.
Good evening, Tracy. Yes, Texas has long been a red state, but with 40 electoral votes up for grabs, it's become a battleground state for control of the U.S. Senate. You literally have to go back to decades, to the 1976 presidential election with Jimmy Carter when he won Texas. From the start of last night's debate, the abortion issue was front and center. Senator Ted Cruz says people of good faith can disagree.
People are genuinely and deeply pro-life. People are genuinely and deeply pro-choice. And there are all sorts of positions in between. I agree with the United States Supreme Court that under our Constitution, the way we resolve questions like that, questions on which we have real and genuine disagreements, is at the ballot box.
Congressman Allred countered that he supports Roe v. Wade and adds Senator Cruz's pro-life position is out of touch with the American people.
It's not pro-life to deny women care so long that they can't have children anymore. It's not pro-life to force a victim of rape to carry their rapist's baby. It's not pro-life that our maternal mortality rate has skyrocketed up by 56%. That's not pro-life, Senator.
The two also clashed over border security.
Congressman Allred has said publicly, if you believe border security matters, he thinks you're a racist. He calls the border wall, quote, that racist border wall. And he has pledged to tear down that racist border wall personally. And he said, quote, we will not have that wall in this country.
I believe in physical barriers as part of a comprehensive strategy to secure the border. We had a bill for $20 billion for 1,000 new Border Patrol agents, for more immigration judges, more asylum officers to help us deal with the backlog. I wanted to make sure we passed that.
Congressman Allred attacked Senator Cruz on denying the previous election results and over January 6th.
You can't be for the mob on January 6th and for the officers. You can't. And it's not funny because you're a threat to democracy.
11.5 million illegal immigrants have come into this country under Kamala Harris and Colin Allred's open border policies. And Congressman Allred votes no to protecting our elections and ensuring that people don't vote illegally. That is a threat to democracy.
According to recent polls, Congressman Allred is already closing the gap. He's just under 3%. Democrats are pouring in a massive amount of money into this race, but Senator Cruz says that he's yet to receive any money from the Republican Senate PAC. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Well, the Republican candidate for governor in North Carolina has filed a lawsuit against CNN. CNN's report accused Mark Robinson of posting explicit racial and sexual comments on a pornography site. Robinson is calling the reporting reckless and defamatory. The lawsuit seeks at least $50 million in damages, saying, quote, this is an attack aimed at derailing his campaign for governor. After the report, many GOP members, including Donald Trump, have distanced themselves from Robinson. CNN has declined to comment on the lawsuit. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including bank statement. U.S. financial institutions post stronger than expected third quarter earnings, what it could mean for the U.S. economy. Morgan Stanley became the latest U.S. financial institution to beat estimates for the third quarter profits. And after the news, its shares went up 7%. Other U.S. banks also beat gloomy third quarter forecasts, including Citigroup and Bank of America. And while the stronger than expected earnings are good for banks' bottom lines, what impact does it have on the U.S. economy and the election? To help us answer that and more, let's bring in Paul Dykowitz, editor, columnist, and senior analyst at StockInvestor.com. Paul, great to have you back on the show. Appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. So what do these better-than-expected earnings indicate, not just for the financial institutions, but also for the economy?
Well, it shows recession right now is at bay. Does it mean that we're going to totally avoid the risk of recession? No, it doesn't. But for today, it's good news. We also have, improving inflation, and we have the job market still being strong. And the other good news is the gold prices and also, other types of stocks besides banks have been doing well lately, and the market just hit a new high.
Yeah.
The question is whether that's sustainable. And there are some definite risks. People are still really concerned about inflation. And I think inflation will be a key issue in the election, with many people not doing as well as they needed to keep up with the inflation in the Trump administration was a little over 7% during his 4 years. Of course, that involves some COVID years, which were lean, compared to almost triple the inflation during the Biden and Harris administration with less than 4 years. So obviously, some deficit spending fueled the economy, and some people might say it's excessive, depending on your point of view. But nonetheless, that's still putting the economy at risk. And inflation is possibly coming down based on the latest numbers. Could it go back up? Conceivably, that could be the case, but it's moving in the right direction. And the Fed has felt comfortable enough to reduce rates at least once by 50 basis points or 0.5%. And so it's suggesting that there are some opportunities for growth, but still concerned. And some people have not done well enough to keep up with inflation over these last 4 years, thinking if it was more than 20% and their pay didn't go up that much, they're probably feeling financially hurt. And the numbers from a recent Reserve System study found that's exactly the case.
Yeah, Paul, let's talk about the economy overall and how it impacts elections historically. And how do you see it impacting this election?
Well, pocketbook issues often determine the outcome. In this case, you've got, President Trump, former President Trump, who's controversial. Not everybody likes him. Some people are definitely opposed to him. You've got some never Trumpers who are just not going to vote for him regardless. Some people will vote on the pocketbook, and that's traditionally a way that often elections are decided.
in this case, you've got personality issues, and so there's going to be, I think, some more drama in this instance. And I don't think presidential nominee Vice President Harris is as well known, and her policies are as well established as they were with President Biden. So I think she's got a bit more explaining to do. She's done some more media appearances lately. She's trying to make her case, and President Trump always seems to like a crowd. The bigger the crowd, the better. So he's going to be campaigning up until the last night, I'm sure, just like he was the previous time that he ran, and then 4 years before that. So I would expect a tight election up all the way to the very end.
Yeah, not a whole lot of time left, but just quickly want to touch on this. You know, obviously we have final weeks before the election, and both the candidates you mentioned have really been focusing on the economy and touting their plans to get those voters who maybe are still undecided. And yesterday, as you know, former President Trump spoke at the Economic Club of Chicago and discussed some of his plans. Also talked about, part of the plan, the imposing those cross-the-board tariffs on imported foreign goods, something he believes will incentivize companies to build factories here in the U.S. in order to avoid those tariffs. But some economists believe that's only going to raise prices for consumers. Really quickly, in layman's terms, can you explain this to us, Paul, and your thoughts on it?
Yes, it will create higher prices for consumers, although, presidential candidate Harris has also said she would support tariffs. President Trump likes that strategy. It actually does raise prices for consumers, but it can also help to protect U.S. jobs. Most economists, free market economists especially, say that's not a good policy to have. It could lead to other countries retaliating. On the other hand, it could lead to negotiations if President Trump intends to do that, to threaten to do that, to get negotiating going with other countries that could end up benefiting America. But it's hard to know with President Trump because he says a lot of things. Sometimes he exaggerates, as we all know. Some people would say it's more than exaggerating at times. But, I don't know what his strategy is longer term to negotiate things, but that's a risk to have higher prices for consumers. It would help to drive inflation. But both candidates right now are saying the same thing. They would support tariffs. So there's not a whole lot of difference between them in terms of that particular policy leg that they're both standing on.
Yeah, and all this remains to be seen. All right, Paul, thank you so much for coming on. Always appreciate it.
Pleasure always. Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Reconciled Differences, why Pope Francis says that he has hopes for unification among the Catholics, Orthodox, and Protestants. Plus, a procession to wake up the faith of the people in the city that never sleeps. Francis says that he is hoping the Catholic Church will fully reconcile with Orthodox and Protestant Christians.
L'importante è che queste differenze siano riconciliate.
In his weekly talk at the Vatican, the Holy Father acknowledged the centuries-old dispute that has divided the East and West. He added that more recent signs have emerged that the tension is starting to thaw, and he continues to hope to a full mutual acceptance. Well, during the third week of the Synod, the international delegates gathered this afternoon in St. Peter's Basilica for a Mass celebrated by a church leader from Mexico. Cardinal Carlos Aguiar Reyes, delegate president of the Synod, delivered the homily. He focused on the importance of trusting in the Lord for divine assistance in our daily lives.
Considero que es oportuno interrogarnos.
I think it is opportune to ask ourselves how committed we are to living and promoting synodality in our own areas of ecclesial and social responsibility. Surely we will have expectations conditioned by our own social and ecclesial contexts. But we must remember in our ordinary prayer that we will certainly not lack the assistance of the Holy Spirit when fostering our specific tasks on our own synodal journey and in our own synodal practice.
After more than a decade of renovation work, a major cathedral in California is now complete. Christ Cathedral in California was once a Protestant megachurch. The Diocese of Orange County purchased it back in 2011. It has been fully operational for 5 years while renovations were ongoing. It hosts close to a dozen masses every weekend in multiple languages, serving around 12,000 Catholics. The diocese called its completion a, quote, milestone moment. Well, finally tonight, if you've caught EWTN's ongoing coverage of the Napa Institute's 2024 Faith and Business Conference, Tuesday's events featured a massive Eucharistic procession through New York City. The events began with a holy hour followed by Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, which led right into the procession. As you can see from the footage, the Eucharist went through Manhattan with priests, religious, and the faithful. It wrapped up with benediction. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. We leave you tonight with more from the Eucharistic procession in Manhattan. Good night, and God bless.